supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Borderline personality disorder is one of the most misunderstood of all diagnoses. Therapists often stay away from people treating people carrying this label. Although it only affects 1 to 2% of the population, the rate of depression, suicide attempts, and completed suicides are higher here than any other diagnosis. And their behavior includes unstable moods, unstable interpersonal relationships, self-injury, and impulsive behavior. But none of those words captures the human side of this label. How those with borderline suffer from anxiety, self-loathing, shame, and terrible, terrible loneliness. One of my guests today on today's show is Talia Lewis, who shares her struggles living with this illness and her eventual recovery. She's written The Boom Boom Retreat, which chronicles her years growing up in and out of psychiatric institutions. Today, she's a psychoanalytic fellow with her own private consulting practice. Talia, thanks so much for joining us.
Dan, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's good to see you again after these years since you've been on before.
4 years.
Yeah.
A long time.
We're also going to be hearing later on from Edie Mannion, who is the manager and co-founder of the Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. Mannion runs support groups for families and talks to them about their needs and coping strategies. Well, if you want to join our conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If you have had, been diagnosed with, or worry about someone in your family with borderline, please give us a call. So first I have to ask you, Talia, do you have borderline? Did you have? Are you recovering?
I certainly met all 9 of the criteria. I mean, they're behaviors, so I think, you know, they're misdiagnoses sometimes with the disorder, but from what I understand, I certainly appeared very much as though I had borderline disorder. Do I appear that way now? No. I'm in recovery and would no longer be diagnosable.
What do you mean by in recovery?
It means that the behaviors are not a part of my life. I don't struggle with the anguish. I don't self-injure. I have a self-image that is pretty high, especially compared to the way it used to be. I feel very good about myself. You wouldn't look at me and sit with me and experience me as someone with borderline disorder at this point.
No, not at all. I look at you, you smile easily, and it's genuine.
Yeah,
you look comfortable inside your own skin. That is not typical of someone with this diagnosis.
Exactly.
You said you felt different as young as kindergarten.
As far back as I can remember, absolutely. I had a really difficult time relating to other kids for as long as I can remember. I don't ever remember feeling at ease and really knowing how to engage with other kids.
Dis-ease. You tell a story about one little girl. What was her name? Carrie. A very popular girl who wanted to play with you.
Yes.
Tell us it.
This was in the second grade. And I remember Carrie running up to me and grabbing on my shirt. And I knew that Carrie was trying to engage me in play. I was aware of that. It wasn't a malicious grabbing. It was a fun grabbing. But I didn't really know in general how to respond to people, to my peers. So I would have to search my memory bank on how I remembered seeing other people responding to similar situations. And with Carrie, I was able to search my memory bank and know, okay, grab my shirt. There she is running across the classroom. Time for me to chase her. What I didn't know was what to do once I caught up to her.
So I listened to you, and I wonder about the brain of that little girl who there's some deficit in the brain around the issue of social skills and self relative to others. And I wonder about the brain of someone with Asperger's or on the autism continuum. Now, bipolar and autism are very different phenomena, but this is how someone who is verbal with Asperger's describes their life. I interviewed a man years ago who was 50 years old, finally got diagnosed with Asperger's. Mm-hmm. And he talked about his loneliness his whole life, that he's wanted to have a close relationship and didn't know how to do it. And he came to mind when you talked about your experience with Kerry.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know very much or actually anything about Asperger's, but absolutely, I mean, there was this constant desperation to have attachments with other people. And I would push through bullying. I would push through anything, really, I had to do in order to make connections. It wouldn't work. So the relationships were always very rocky. There was a lot of turmoil around the relationships. But the need for that attachment felt profound for me, yet very slippery at the same time.
And what do you mean slippery?
I couldn't hang on to them.
Yeah.
I couldn't hang on to
them. And that's what we hear. Mm-hmm. So psychoanalytic, Talia. Speaking of attachments.
So, by the way, I'm an academic fellow, so I think that's important to clarify.
Translate that into English, please.
Well, my role at the Psychoanalytic Center in terms of the fellowship is all about academic learning. They're clinical fellows who are in practice, and even though I do have a private peer consulting practice, it's different. I'm not a therapist. I'm not a psychologist, and my fellowship is an academic fellowship. So it's all about the academic learning.
Well, I appreciate the clarification. Yeah. However, you've got a way of looking at family dynamics. Mm-hmm. So tell us about your family and your understanding of what happened. What contributed to this?
Absolutely. Well, in my family, I mean, my parents are very loving and they're still alive, and now we have a wonderful relationship, and I always try to use as much tact and be as delicate as I can, because I do believe they did the best they knew how. But there was really very little connection. My parents were socialites, and they spent much of their time with the elite in the city where I grew up in, which was not Philadelphia. We moved to Philadelphia a little bit later. And there was really very, I wouldn't say neglect, because it wasn't intentional neglect. My mother was loving when she was around, but my sister and I were alone a lot. And our representation of ourselves, really, I think, was one of not deserving and of other relationships being never really available, never really present. I mean, if you think about children learn about themselves and about others, about themselves and relationships through those early dynamics with mom and dad, when mom and dad aren't around, I sense very much the message that you're not valuable enough to be around. And I think I picked up on that. And there was some verbal abuse and things that happened in the home that certainly affected my self-esteem.
How about your sister?
The experience was different for her. It was difficult for her as well, but it was different. She was older. She identified more with the role of being the big sister and with the role of being the good girl for my parents, where I had more the role of being the rebellious bad girl in the home. So though it was very difficult for her as well, she lived in the same home with parents busy with other things, it felt different for her.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Talia Lewis, who was diagnosed, is recovering from...
Recovered. Thank you.
From borderline personality disorder. She chronicled her life so far in the Boom Boom Retreat, and we're going to hear details about what that title means. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Please call early in the show. We were talking about your understanding of some of the dynamics that went into your emotional state. My research shows that there's a great genetic component here also. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts about that? Anyone else in your family with mood instability?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they actually know through research that it happens five times more often in first-degree relatives. So absolutely, we see this. My grandmother, I never met her. She died actually when my mother was 21, so long before I was born. But what my mother shares about her mother was she was very unstable. And one evening, my mother and I were sitting in my father's study, the two of us. It was very late at night. We were having a nightcap. And I kind of went through the criteria of borderline disorder. My mother didn't know what I was doing. We were just chatting, and I was getting information about my grandmother. And it appeared as though she met quite a bit of the criteria. And, you know, I think my sister has struggled in her life also with certain of the features of borderline disorder.
Yeah, you know, as I listen to you talk, I'm getting less comfortable with that label even than I was before mm-hmm. we went on the air. So what I see is difficulty with moods, with mood stability. It's like it takes a hair trigger. And a mood can switch. It can turn from love to hate to neediness to that's a lot of what I'm hearing. And, you know, one of the themes of your life, as I read it in your book, is one of shame.
Oh, absolutely.
And so, you know, I'm hearing these unstable moods. And, boy, that nails an awful lot of what goes into this diagnosis. And what comes out of that is all this shame, loneliness, alienation, feeling unlovable, mm-hmm. because you're behaving in a way that makes you unlovable and you can't control it.
You can't control it. I mean, really, when I think of borderline disorder and we think of the nine criteria, which are really just a bunch of behaviors that we see even in other disorders, I really try to I think about it in these four areas of experience. It's really it's about relationships. It's about emotional dysregulation. It's about impulsivity. And it's about a sense of a self, of a continuous good sense of self with a future. And really that's how I kind of categorize it as an experience.
And they're all related, of course.
And they're all related.
Sure.
Absolutely. I also would like to point out that I was the only one in my family diagnosed. So I did mention something about my sister. I mean, she was never diagnosed. I just think that, you know, there were struggles for her through her life.
So. You know, I referred in the introduction about this, quote, dreaded diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And therapists run away.
They do.
From this often. And you know, they say because they don't have time for, you know, long term. But you rolled your eyes, young lady, when I said that.
I did.
So that's the problem with being on live radio here. I can, you know.
Yes, everyone, I rolled my eyes. Absolutely.
Why?
Because, frankly, if you understand what's motivating the behaviors that you're seeing in this disorder, the relationship can be very, very different. And, again, I do have to be very clear that I'm not a therapist, I'm not a psychologist, but I do have a private peer consulting practice, and people do come in to work through some of their behaviors with me as someone who has experienced them and who reads a lot about the symptomology and how to work with it. And my experience of the people that I work with is so different from the experience that they might have shared their former therapist might have had or that I hear other therapists talk about, because I also teach on the disorder. I conduct workshops. And I've yet to experience them as horrifically as they seem to be represented or the way others seem to have remembered me or experienced me when I was going through it.
Because why do you think that is?
I think when you understand that someone is behaving for a reason and you always remain curious about what that reason is as opposed to making assumptions, then you can meet them where they are, and they feel understood, and they're much more likely to engage.
You know, there's a label for that kind of approach. Really, it's called good therapy, but it's also trauma-informed therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about that trauma-informed workplaces, hospitals, everywhere. And I wonder how much PTSD goes with bipolar.
Borderline disorder?
I mean, borderline.
Yeah.
Do you have post-traumatic stress disorder?
I definitely, my behavior is definitely presented as though there was traumatic material from my past. I have a lot of amnesia from my childhood. There's much that I don't remember. So I do have to be curious what would have me forget the majority of my childhood.
Yeah.
That's really, right now, that's as far as I can actually go with that, other than my parents being relatively absent because of the things they wanted to do and some of the verbal abuse that happened in the house. I don't know. I really have to say I don't know, because I don't remember.
Can I throw out two possibilities?
You may.
That you don't remember, A, because what you seem to be implying, that there was trauma that went underground, and or B, that what you're describing is difficulties in your brain wiring, your limbic system, and all of that going on at that age, mm-hmm. prevented you from laying down good memory tracks.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be one or the other, or a combination of both. And of course, there's always
that.
None of the above. Yeah.
You know, I kind of imagine when we think of people who are so amnesic for huge parts of their life, you kind of, or at least for me, I imagine someone who just can't escape something physically, so they escape it through their mind, and that becomes detached.
Sure.
I mean, we call it dissociation.
Of course.
I mean, I didn't come up with this. It's and so.
When did you wake up?
When did I wake up?
Yeah.
This morning. When did I wake up?
Faye, you sound like me. It's not a compliment.
I'm going to take it as one. So, when did I wake up? When did I start remembering my life from one day to the next?
Yeah.
That's a good question, because the treatment that I went through when I was initially diagnosed, though it helped in part, it was a very behaviorally based treatment, which really had me looking as if to mm-hmm. other people mm-hmm. I was as well as I appeared to be. What people were missing was that even though my behaviors were under control, I knew how to manage them. I was able to get a job. I went to school. I got my bachelor's degree in psychology, of course. I got married, started a family. The anguish, the internal stuff had not changed. I really didn't wake up until many, many years later, when my oldest daughter began to trigger me without my realizing I was being triggered, and I went back into treatment.
And that's when you became aware of your life, not just your history, but just kind of wake up and mm-hmm. say, I'm here. This is me. This is my life. This is real.
I really wasn't willing to do that. Not consciously. This wasn't
sure,
a conscious
sure,
thing. But let's say parts of my mind really weren't yeah. willing to do that until I started working more on the traumatic material, which, you know, I haven't really gotten to it, but I can feel it. You know, the emotional experiences that interfere so much then, it was really working through that stuff.
I want to talk about some of the trauma you clearly experienced when you were hospitalized.
Yes.
And you were hospitalized in relative modern times. I mean, we're not talking about the dark ages.
Felt so, like it, but
yeah,
no.
Yeah. And when we come back, I also want to bring in Edie Mannion, who's manager and co-founder of the Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. And I know you and Edie have got some professional connections over the years with that support group. Well, like I said, we're going to be We'll be back in just 60 seconds. We're talking with Talia Lewis about her memoir, The Boom Boom Retreat. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
If your child is struggling in school, why wait to make a change? Supporting WHYY, Delaware Valley Friends, a Quaker College preparatory school in Paoli for students who learn differently. Delaware Valley Friends is committed to providing small classes, individual attention, state-of-the-art technology, and an accredited curriculum and faculty. Open house Sunday, November 9th at 1 p.m. More info about Delaware Valley Friends at dvfs.org. Now considering mid-year transfers for grades 6 through 11.
Supporting WHYY, Devereaux, one of the leaders in behavioral health care, helps to provide care for children and adolescents with mental health challenges, as well as individuals of all ages living with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Across its national network, Devereaux helps provide meaningful care to individuals and families where they need it most. Whether it be through community and educational programs, employment services, foster care assistance, or individual or group living support. Learn more at devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking with Talia Lewis about her memoir, The Boom Boom Retreat, which I highly recommend. You've got the eye of a poet. And it chronicles her life with borderline personality disorder. We're joined now by Edie Mannion, who's I described her earlier. She's run support groups for families and talks to them about their needs and coping strategies. Edie.
Yeah, hi, Dan. Thank you for having me on again.
Sure. Good to speak with you.
Yes.
So we were talking about, Talia was talking about her family, her parents. What goes on with families? And I wonder about, I don't want you to talk about Talia, of course, but what goes on with parents? I can only imagine the guilt and shame they must feel.
Well, Talia and I came up with this workshop called Getting Off the Emotional Roller Coaster because that's sort of what it feels like, I think, to be in a close relationship with someone who's, goes to extremes easily and quickly. So they often feel the whole gamut of emotions, and it's like a conversation can start out well, and they might say something well-meaningly, and the person gets triggered because of how they're interpreting it, and they begin to get angry. The family member can get defensive, saying, I was only trying to help, don't yell at me, and it just goes, south from there. So there's, I think families can go through a whole gamut of extreme emotions right along with the person.
Shame, guilt, anger, helplessness, hopelessness.
Yep.
Yeah. Talia, what's it like for you on the other end when your family, when people in general, therapists, but I guess your family in particular, get defensive or angry at you when you're desperately trying to X, fill in the blank.
Well, now it doesn't happen anymore. So our relationship is really, really very good right now. When I was younger, there was just a lot of turmoil, a lot of fighting. I argued. It looked like I was just the very, very extreme, rebellious, over-the-top kid. And in many ways, that's what it was. But then it was just intensified with the sensitivity of it, because I could get triggered by anything my parents would do really very, very quickly. And absolutely, they didn't understand it. So for them,
What's the it they needed to understand? What did you want from them?
To understand where I was coming from.
I'm going to push you on this. You wanted more than understanding from your parents.
I wanted validation. I wanted them to know that my behaviors weren't there just because. Someone doesn't develop behaviors of extreme suicidality, self-injury, self-hatred. People don't respond to their environment in such a volatile way.
Unless.
And that unless is different for different families.
Tell me your unless.
Well, my unless was pretty absent parents that really were more involved in their life than their children's life, verbal abuse. I mean, that was my unless. And again, was there more? There may have been more. I don't remember big pieces of my childhood, so there may have been more to that unless for me as well.
You wanted to be, you said validated. You wanted to be loved, held. You wanted to be taken in. You wanted to feel felt.
And to be allowed to feel. I think one of the biggest problems is that so frequently when parents experience their children, even their healthy children, dysregulated, because everybody gets dysregulated sometimes, there's this desire to very quickly put out the fire. Because if you're dysregulated, emotions are contagious. I'm mom. I'm going to get dysregulated. I don't want to be dysregulated, so I'm going to shut down my child's feelings. And this happens frequently. I think when you have someone who's relatively healthy in a relatively validating environment, what we would call good enough parenting, that works out okay. When we have someone who perhaps was born with an exquisite sensitivity or perhaps developed it because of abusive scenarios, that feels like such a disconnect, because here I am having an emotional experience that is very, very big and very, very frightening, and it's not being responded to.
Bring us closer to that emotional experience.
Loneliness. Fear. I was terrified as a little kid, actually through middle school even, so not even so much a little kid, to be by myself. Not so much a fear of loneliness, though, yes, there was a fear of loneliness, but to actually walk outside by myself, to stay at home by myself at ages that most kids don't have an issue with that.
Do you know what you were afraid of?
My guess, well, I used to think to myself that my fear was stray dogs. And when I think back to that now, I was never bitten by a stray dog. I didn't encounter stray dogs. I think it became something real that I could put my internal fears that I didn't understand onto. It makes so much more sense to be afraid of a stray dog than to be afraid of your entire
yourself.
Internal experience.
Right.
Yes. So my mother would ask me to go run errands. I would flip out anytime I was asked to go buy milk because it meant I had to go walk outside by myself. But from her perspective, I didn't want to go buy the milk.
You couldn't. And you couldn't verbalize.
I could not
verbalize
it.
Because you were a little kid.
I was a little kid. Even as I got older, even when I was 12, 13, yes, you're still a little kid then, but I couldn't verbalize it then either.
Well, even if you could, you were probably so filled with shame.
Yes.
And you were probably going to a great lengths to hide.
Absolutely.
To
shame.
Hide you from them.
Sure. To hide me from the world.
Everybody. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, shame really is the core experience when we talk about borderline disorder. And I think sometimes shame is missed, the importance of shame, even in recovery from this disorder.
It's everything.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Gene on the line. Hi, Gene.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Oh, I've had a very long-term issue with a younger brother who's got a combination of borderline personality disorder and intermittent explosive disorder. And he started exhibiting these symptoms around the time of puberty. And we came from a family of five, and he's in the middle. And he didn't seem to, because I was very close to him before puberty, and then, so he wasn't undergoing anything unusual. But once he hit that age, something kicked in, and he was became very sexually aggressive towards women. He was very aggressive towards men. Started having,
Gene,
intermittent episodes of violence.
What can we do for you, for him?
Well, at this point, I mean, it's taken me forever to get my family to coalesce around an organized way of helping him, because at this point he's got arrest warrants out for him from me, from other people in the area. He can't even come visit his parents, and the difficulty is he'll once he has these episodes, he will sort of apologize, but always find ways to blame other people.
What would you like from our experts here? How can we help?
What is the best kind of therapy for someone with that combination of problems?
Is he willing to get therapy?
He might have to be coerced into it.
Okay. So I want our guests to talk about your brother, and I want our guests to talk about you and the rest of your family. So I'm going to start with you, Edie Mannion. I thought of you when he first started talking about his lifetime and his distress and a family coalescing around this.
Yeah, I thought Gene, that you said, you know, took us a while to coalesce around an organized way of helping him was very exquisitely said. But I just think it is what we would call a major ambiguous loss when someone changes like that, and you were once close, and then their personality and behavior changes so dramatically, and they're not like the same person, but sometimes that you see glimmers of the person. So there's a lot of pain and loss that families have to sort of recover from and then figure out what they're going to do, and it can take years.
What options does a family have here?
Well, I think coming together and agreeing that they're going to do something different is a first step. And then, you know, not everybody may be on the same page. So some members may be more angry at the person. Others are more, you know, anxious and worried. So sometimes, like we do here at the Mental Health Association, family consultation, which does not include the person because the person may not even be willing, you know, to come in or to admit they have a problem, but we just try to help the family figure out how they can get on the same page and what they're going to do together. And then their options are to get some support. There are many families going through this. They can come to support groups. There's online chat rooms. There are workshops. We have a 10-week workshop. There are other workshops where you can learn skills. There's an excellent book called Loving Someone with Borderline Personality Disorder by Sherry Manning, which I highly recommend. It's a lot to recover from and a lot to learn.
Let me turn to you, Talia. When Gene was describing his brother, what was that like for you? Did you have any feelings or any thoughts for Gene?
Yeah, well, one of the things that came to mind was, or that stuck out for me, was when Gene, when you mentioned that everything seemed fine until he hit puberty. And one of the things that's very important to understand is the whole idea of perspective. And everyone's perspective can really be very, very different, even when they've lived what seems like the same life because they grew up with the same parents in the same home. And what can feel like and I'm going to use the word traumatic, not because it was necessarily a trauma that an individual experienced, but what can feel traumatic to an individual can be very different than what can feel traumatic to another individual. And I don't know your brother. I don't know if there's some physiological things going on with him, and I don't know if he's been checked out for that. So you always have to keep in mind physical issues that could be causing behavioral changes. But if not, you have to really become curious about what the experience growing up was like for him. And it may have been very different from yours. And things also happen to kids outside of the home that families don't necessarily become privy to unless until their behavioral changes. And one of the things that happens when people have experienced their life to be difficult, painful, if they have things that they might experience as having been traumatic, even if they weren't objectively traumatic, is that they get very, very easily triggered by external cues, by internal cues. And that may be what you're seeing in your brother.
And even if not trauma per se, as you say, Talia, that, you know, cognitive researchers neurologists say that neurons that fire together wire together. So we laid down these habitual pathways in our brain that, you know, certain behaviors cause certain reactions, and we do it over and over and over again, regardless of our diagnosis. That's just how the brain works. So that is also a factor in what's going on with him and the rest of us who engage in habitual behaviors. Mm-hmm. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, I do want to talk about your hospitalizations. I want to talk about your therapies, what worked and what didn't work. We'll cover both. We're talking with Talia Lewis. Her memoir is called The Boom Boom Retreat. We're also speaking with Edie Mannion. She's manager and co-founder of the Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. Like I said, we'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at IamConcerned.org.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps private foundations by partnering on administration and grant making. Private foundations also can establish a donor-advised fund to save time and reduce costs. What's more, the Philadelphia Foundation also offers solutions when a private foundation has run its course. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philofound.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host, talking with Talia Lewis, who's written The Boom Boom Retreat, and Edie Mannion, who runs support groups for families where they're suffering with a family member with bipolar disorder.
Borderline disorder. That happens
frequently. Although they do often co-occur, that's one.
Thank you for trying to save me. I'm beyond
I'm a rescuer.
Talia, I want to come back to the theme of shame that we talked about earlier. There are many years where neither you, your parents, or sister spoke a word about this history of yours. Even your husband, you were married how many years before it came out?
18
years before it came out. You had children. Mm-hmm. So it didn't come out until you had difficulty with your daughter, yes?
It was one of my daughters was, and it had nothing to do with my daughter.
Sure.
I thought it did. She was triggering me, and I ended up by the recommendation of someone that we were working with her. She just has some ADD issues, which is very common nowadays. And that therapist noticed that I was reacting a little bit bigger than most parents to just typical ADD issues. So she recommended that I go and figure that out because it was impacting my relationship with her, which I did. And that is around the time that I actually started getting curious more about my past and what I had gone through.
I like the way you use the phrase, you know, recommended you go back and figure that out. And then you say, so I did, as though, okay, then next chapter.
Right. Well, it actually didn't go quite that smoothly.
I didn't think so.
If you read the book, you'll see it didn't go quite that smoothly. But I did, though. I took a recommendation, and though with a lot of anger and resentment and feelings of rejection from her, I did. I went back. And this was, at this point, two decades after my last hospitalization.
What happened to you in the hospital? How did you get there, and what happened that you stayed there?
Wow, that's a big question. How did I get there? Very simply, I got there because I overdosed. in the lobby of my high school. I overdosed on a bottle of sleeping pills in the lobby of my high school, and that became the beginning of long-term treatment. I overdosed in the lobby of my high school because my high school was had already told my parents that they were going to expel me, but they gave my parents the opportunity before they did expel me to try to get me treatment. And my mother did. She brought me to three different therapists, and all three of them, by the second or third visit, refused to treat me. I was too angry. I was too out of control. I was basically they weren't giving me the diagnosis at that point. I don't think I was in treatment long enough with anyone to get it, but I think they were in their minds suspecting or knowing that these were the kinds of behaviors that they were going to have to deal with me. So they all refused to treat me. None of those treatments worked out. I overdosed, ended up in a general hospital for a week, and from there was transferred to this place that I never even knew existed, and that was a psychiatric hospital.
How long were you there?
They did, at those times, long-term treatment. So my first hospitalization was a year. Then I was out for a couple months, and I was back in for, you know, several months and out, then back in for a year. Over the course of about four and a half years, I was inpatient much more than I was outpatient because they kept you for a very long time.
You're talking about in those days. Those days are relatively recent. I mean, this was, when were you in the 80s?
Late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah. I guess that was a long, long time ago, and we didn't hesitate to put children in hospitals back then. What happened to you in the hospital? I mean, I'm assuming that your treatment wasn't stellar and your growth was not linear.
No, my treatment was not stellar. Though I have to say, and I have to believe this, that they were really doing the best they knew how for the time.
Mm-hmm.
There were some bad things that happened. There were some not so good people that were part of my treatment team, but there were some amazing people that genuinely cared and were doing what they thought they were supposed to be doing. However, what they thought they were supposed to be doing were things like seclusion, restraints. When they would put you in restraints, I think now they have to do 15-minute checks, and as soon as you've calmed down, they take you out of them. Then, when they put you in restraints, whether it was 10 o'clock in the evening or even earlier, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you were in restraints till the next morning, always. Once you were in till the next morning. There was actually one occasion that I was in restraints for 3 days, but I was taken out to have a visit with my mother and eat an Entenmann's cake, and then I was back in, which really didn't make sense even to me back then, because I was obviously in control if I could visit with mother and have an Entenmann's cake. So it was behavioral, but it was punishment.
Sure, it was punishment.
They also did room restriction. You would get restricted to your room for 12 hours, and if you used any kind of language because you were angry that you got room restriction, they would throw on another 6 hours, and there was punishment.
That's why you call it in your book incarceration.
Well, yeah, no. Actually, now I'm going to start saying that's why, because that's actually a much better reason why. Thank you for that. The reason why I call it incarceration is because institutionalization makes me feel more shame and weak, whereas incarceration, for how silly this may sound to listeners, incarceration is tougher. And for me, it kind of takes some of the shame out of it. Does that make sense?
Sure it does.
Yeah. So yeah. That's why I call it incarceration, and it's, I think it's kind of a shame-based thing for me, or I know it's a shame-based thing for me.
So now that you know, what do you want to call it?
I'm going to keep calling it incarceration, thank you. And I'm going to start using your reason, though. I like that one.
Edie, when you were on a few years ago, we talked about the gold standard for this treatment. And that was dialectical behavior therapy. So any other treatments? How does that work? Does it work?
Well, it's been the most studied, and it I think there are now 4 evidence-based treatments, but I think DBT or dialectical behavior therapy has had the most, you know, controlled research. And it's very good for helping people get their behavior under control. And that's important. And then some of these other treatments can be very effective in addition to helping people go a little deeper and understand, you know, how they develop certain beliefs, how they interpret other people's behavior. That's mentalization-based therapy helps people with their mentalizing, and schema therapy helps people with their underlying beliefs and the kinds of behaviors those beliefs trigger. And transference-based therapy, you know, is the old standard psychoanalytic therapy with, you know, people who understand more about borderline personality disorder and can really work with the transference and countertransference in the relationship. So we now have more choices than I think when I was on the show before, but I think DBT, and I'm a DBT therapist, and I've also studied these other two. I work at the DBT Center of Greater Philadelphia as well, and we've seen amazing results with DBT. But it's not for everybody.
Yeah, you're not kidding. I'm watching Talia over there, and she went from eye-rolling to clenching her hand so tightly together that I worry about circulation there.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so go on.
I think DBT absolutely has its place, and I would never, ever knock a therapy, especially one that I haven't received myself. And one that I haven't been trained in. I've done a reading about DBT. And I think it's wonderful, in, as Edie said, in helping people get their behaviors under control. When I hear DBT, it makes me think very much of not the kind of treatment I have, because DBT is really about validation and meeting the person where they are, and there's a softness to it that I did not get in my traumatic treatment. But one of the things that my treatment left me was with that as if to other people, as if I were doing better than I really felt. And I think that that happens with DBT at times for some. My concern with DBT, and I have a lot of clients that have been through DBT and felt as though they were at a place in their life that they were really managing, and then found themselves getting triggered without realizing, because they thought that they were in recovery and there was stuff that was left that they hadn't worked through.
So I've been commenting.
And that's kind of what happened to me.
I've been commenting on your body language. You see mine, which is confusion here. And I'll tell you why. When you talk about controlling behavior, putting you in a position of as if, behaving as if. And you know, I think of the phrase from 12-step meetings. You know, it's fake it until you make it. Mm-hmm. And there's some research that supports that you engage in certain behaviors that suggest health. You engage in certain healthy behaviors, and it actually begins to change the way you feel about yourself in your world. And I don't know if you're saying that or something different.
Well, it you know, behavioral treatments do. And it did offer me the kind of behavioral treatment I got. I definitely went from someone whose relationships would dissolve very, very quickly to someone whose relationships would last much longer but still dissolve. I went from someone who couldn't work, who couldn't go to school, who really couldn't manage, to someone who could. I have people in my life. I have a friend in my life that has been very, very close for over 2 decades. As a matter of fact, she's in the acknowledgments of my book. Mm. I have a friend that would have been very close to me for over 2 decades if there hadn't been a shame-based interruption. She's Nancy in my book. But I still always had to manage. I still had the anguish about myself, about relationships, and the
fear.
There
was more. There was more. Tell me what worked.
What ultimately worked was, first, I think it's important to not stay in any one paradigm and to know that there has to be an eclectic approach. There's a time to introduce skills, which early in treatment was crucial and is crucial to develop safety, whether you incorporate some DBT ideas or mentalization ideas or cognitive behavioral ideas. But I think the three-phase approach was the most useful for me. And that was containment and safety, really developing the relationship with the therapist that I ultimately really was able to work on some material with, and and was offered skills and different ways to be able to respond to my own feelings in between sessions. And then once safety and containment was established, though it's not linear, it's a back and forth thing, but just for the sake of the show, once safety and containment was established, then being able to really work through and process the things that disrupted my life in the first place.
You know, in nature, Talia, nothing grows without safety. Nothing.
No,
plants
exactly.
Don't grow. Nothing grows without safety.
No.
So that's where it has to begin.
Yes.
And Talia, you mentioned about eclectic.
Yes.
I love to quote Aaron Beck, who is the founder mm-hmm. of Cognitive. And he was on the show, 25 years ago. And I said, if your young daughter needed a therapist and you were out of town, would you look up the best cognitive therapist you could find? He said, absolutely not. He said, I'd look for the best therapist I could find. Cognitive after that.
Yes. Actually, they've done research and they found that what really aids in recovery isn't even so much a kind of therapy, but it's the therapeutic alliance.
It's the relationship.
And the relationship and the amount of warmth, actually, that the client experiences with the therapist.
There's even more research that shows it ain't just therapy. It's the relationships, mm-hmm. The more we have, the better they are, the happier we are, the healthier we are, which is kind of how we started the show. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I am so grateful to you for your courage, for writing this book, for informing us and teaching us all about you and about this, quote, dreaded diagnosis. Thank you so much.
Dan, thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Edie Mannion, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
You're very welcome.
Great.
I'm honored, and congratulations, Talia.
Thanks, Edie.
All right.
So to download our podcast, go to whyy.org/voices to reach me. I'm at drdangottlieb.com. And next week, we're talking about the double-edged sword of hope. When does it help and when does it hurt? Well, the engineer for today's show has been Adam Staniszewski. Elizabeth Perez-Lunar is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Lindsay Carfagno is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. Oh, I forgot. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Have a good week, my friend. We'll